From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. There is no shortage of voices demanding everyone pay attention to the violence trans women suffer. But one frighteningly basic question seems never to be answered. Why does it happen? If men are not inherently evil and trans women do not intrinsically invite reprisal, which would make this kind of violence unstoppable, then the psychology of that violence had to arise at a certain place and time. The trans panic had to be invented. This is the description for historian and gender scholar Dr. Jules Gill Peterson's new book, The Short History of Transmisogyny, a work that seeks to answer why transmisogyny is such a ubiquitous reality. Because without this understanding, Jules says, we can never move beyond awareness into liberation for trans femme people. At a time when legislative attacks on trans people are at an all-time high and a pernicious focus on their lives and healthcare dominates public discourse, this question and this exploration provides an important path forward. Joining us to discuss is Jules herself, Associate Professor of History at Johns Hopkins University and author of the 2018 book Histories of the Transgender Child. Jules, welcome to At Liberty, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Kendall. Very excited to be here.
I should say welcome back to At Liberty, because you have been with us before, which we're so honored to have you again. We have so much to get to. This is a very important book, and I will say just first and foremost that I felt your work was such a book of both art and scholarship.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
Yeah. It's true. I really feel that way. We alluded to the why of the short history of transmisogyny in the introduction, but I'd love to hear when this book came into view for you. Where did it come from? What's its origin story in your life and study?
Yeah, it has, unfortunately, perhaps for Bia, although I am a millennial, it has a very online, a kind of chronically online origin story, just that a couple of years ago, kind of during the peak period when people, you know, with middle-class professional jobs, like myself being a professor, were had the privilege of working from home, maybe in 2021, I was online a lot, unfortunately, because of the incredible, at that time, unprecedented rise in anti-trans legislation and targeting of children and youth. My book had become more relevant than ever. And in the midst of that experience, I was just experiencing like just unbelievable levels of daily harassment, threats, all those sorts of things that were relatively new experiences to me. And also just thinking more broadly about my career, the unusualness of being a trans woman of color, you know, with a public-facing professional job. There's very few of us in those roles. And I just kind of started to realize as I was going back to some touchstones, Julia Serrano's book, Whipping Girl, which I think was really responsible for popularizing the term and kind of defining the term transmisogyny in the first place, a book that had kind of been recycled online, passed around. You know, I was like, okay, we have that, but no one has really ever dug into this concept that people use and that there are definitions for, but doesn't have really a robust foundation yet. And I also became really interested in that question of why. We're living in an era of very bad faith politics. And I was like, well, so then it's not really that interesting to ask about motives in terms of like, why are people doing this? What are they gaining from it? But if you zoom out and sort of look like, what's the purpose of transmisogyny? What's the purpose of violence against trans women? You can get at a deeper why. And that to me both felt like an important shift, like register shift in this moment where otherwise, like you were saying at the top, there's so much obsessive focus on violence against trans women, but it generally doesn't lead to anything. And I also just felt like, I mean, this is like part of the function of like a violence like this that's so structural, that's so ambient, that's so all-consuming, is that you almost never stop to ask why it happens. Instead, it just feels like predestination. And that simply to me is unacceptable personally and politically. So that really motivated me to do maybe the most boring thing you could do, which is try and give some historical foundation to this concept that's very much otherwise kind of a 21st century internet term.
Well, it absolutely wasn't boring.
is, glad to hear it.
You know, when I had originally come across the book and was seeing that it was like really digging into this deeper why, I almost felt a little ashamed that I hadn't asked that question before, you know, that I had been part of the mechanism of awareness as enough, perhaps. Before we dive into the actual content of the book, I want to situate our conversation with just some definitions, just because, you know, people coming to listen to this conversation are coming from all different spaces and places. So I want to ask you to define transmisogyny. And, you know, perhaps in the definition, if it's helpful, you could give some examples.
For sure. I mean, you know, misogyny, just to even start before we put the word trans in, is itself kind of a slippery word. I mean, dictionary definition, it's woman hating women, but that's sort of it's an irrational feeling, right? Sort of a hearts and mind kind of thing. And, you know, Julia Serrano had kind of helpfully, I think, already identified a key dynamic in trans misogyny that sort of distinguishes it from other forms of misogyny. So that trans women are subject to a specific kind of presumption and punitive violence that, generally speaking, other women aren't subject to. And it actually often involves homophobia. So that is that trans women are often treated as if they were men, and that inspires a kind of, you know, anti-gay panic response, or just a litany of homophobia that really kind of genders or sexualizes the body of trans women as male in order to justify violence. It doesn't actually have to be a trans woman, but like someone walking down the street, right, who is clocked, you know, rightly or wrongly, doesn't really matter, that person's passive presence is construed as itself an aggression or a threat, right? And so in the classic trans panic defense scenario, you might have a man who has attacked or even possibly killed a trans woman saying, well, we were on a date, or I'd been dating her for a while. And then there was this moment of revelation where I realized, or she disclosed, that she was trans. And that so overwhelmed me because it was so threatening to me. That was almost itself the revelation. The status itself is a form of sexual violence against me. I'm a victim. And so I was authorized for a preemptive strike, right? I was allowed to strike first. And even though that's aggression, it was actually defensive. I was protecting myself, right? And so that really, for me, is kind of the characteristic scene of transmisogyny. I talk about it in the book as one of the rare kind of maneuvers that allows someone to behave as both victim
and aggressor
and judge, jury, and executioner all at once, right? And so it's kind of this bizarre structure, this form of rationalization of a kind of extreme degradation, devaluation of a group of people, targeting them, really intense emphasis on being able to pick them out, separate them out from everyone else, and then kind of unleash a spectacle of violence that's supposed to restore order, you know, moral order, relationship order, you know, state power, what have you. And that, to me, is sort of the characteristic form that distinguishes trans misogyny from other forms of misogyny.
You also talk about the various groups of people who, as you mentioned, gay men, cisgender women, who have really like distanced themselves from trans feminized people in order to keep that structural power in place. And we'll get to more of that in our discussion. I want to talk about transfeminization, because I think that was a new term for me. What does it mean for people to be transfeminized, and why does this matter within the conversation of transmisogyny?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually, despite being a scholar, absolutely abhor inventing terms, and I don't like jargon. So this is a very rare, very reluctant choice on my part, but I think it's really helpful. So transfeminization, it's like a verb, it's a process, it's impersonal. And you might notice what it does immediately is move us out of the realm of identity. one of the reasons why I think that's so important is the dominant way people understand trans people and gender in general right now is through the lens of identity. We talk as if it were true that gender is this sort of personal individual attribute that somewhere on the inside, right, exists and then is expressed outward in the world, which, you know, not a very good description. In many ways, it's just completely untrue. Gender is profoundly social. Even if you, regardless of how you feel yourself to be on the inside, probably everyone has had times where they that inside feeling isn't being given, isn't being recognized or handed over by people out in the world. And so I wanted to both be able to attend to the sociality of gender, but also really pay attention to the fact that trans misogyny does not, as it, the way it's sometimes talked about on the internet, only affect trans women, right? And as I was looking into this history, part of what actually really surprised me, but changed my thinking is that I noticed that this characteristic form of trans misogyny we were just talking about emerged and was, you know, directed towards people who were not trans women at first, but they were treated very much like trans women would be treated later. They were sexualized. Their gender was deemed a problem. They were defeminized in public. They were targeted and punished, but they weren't trans women and they didn't become trans women historically. And so trans feminization, by turning that into a verb, I just want to talk about how this process of violence apprehends someone or a whole group of people without having to prove that those people are trans women, because that's the kind of purity politics or just like analysis that you'll end up wasting all of your time like arguing over, well, what's a trans woman? So I think it's just my attempt to kind of give us some more tools, help us relax a little some of the difficulties I think we often face in understanding and discussing this violence, and let us be more specific. And for me, you know, historically, I think it just blows open some fascinating kinds of questions that honestly were totally new for me.
I do believe it was a very, very valuable framework to add, because as we get into the stories, it will be clear why. But the I think one of the things you write is transgender's greatest accomplishment has thus been to disavow the very people it claims to urgently represent, poor women of color. And I think that what I took from that, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, is that what you were just saying about this very Western idea of labeling and categorizing people and putting a identity on someone as opposed to allowing for self-determination or self-identification. And in that process, having that stripped away from you could also be a gateway to physical violence, that the ability for someone to not be able to identify themselves or determine their own expression could lead to deadly repercussions and has led to deadly repercussions. Is that a fair assessment, or am I wisping away?
No, not at all. I mean, it made me think. I don't usually like to use myself as an example, but it's helpful sometimes, right? Actually, transfeminization, even as a term, helped me make sense of something in my own life experience, which was that I was like targeted from a young age, long before I genuinely had been given or encountered any conceptual resources to understand myself as a trans girl, right? And actually is really complex to figure out how to know that you're different than what every single person is telling you, and even what you're told is the meaning of your physical body. And nevertheless, right, I experienced as a child and an adolescent characteristically trans misogynist forms of gendered violence, sexual violence. So part of what trans feminization would even allow me to say is I was trans feminized even before I knew I was a trans girl. And even, you know, before I transitioned, what I might have been received in the world as a gay boy, I could still be subject to trans misogyny, right? I just think it gives us this sort of nimbleness. And that also gets to what you were just talking about, that it's precisely this kind of culture of euphemism and the kind of intense policing of people, often from a young age, to keep them silent. I mean, that's like very deliberately what a lot of aggressive laws in this country are trying to do right now. Like, we do not want there to be more trans kids in general who will grow up to be adults, but we really don't want there to be trans girls. And so there's a lot of punishment that never gets to the point of saying what it's about, because even that risks too much. It's too dangerous to even admit what we're really punishing here.
It seems to me that no example does better to describe this pathway than the story of Hijra in India. Can you tell us about Hijra?
Absolutely. So if we abruptly wind the clock back 200 years here, I promise there's a reason. This is actually also the origin story to this book. I was reading a wonderful work by historian Jessica Hinchey talking about the British colonial period in India, sort of 1850s to 1890s, this period where the British are really consolidating colonial power, really developing the colonial state administratively, but also developing a police state. And there was this entire panic over this group of people, Hijras, who have been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Hijras are, you know, an ascetic group of people, people with spiritual and religious significance that play a pretty substantial role in, you know, played a pretty substantial role in 19th century North Indian society, kind of as sacred supporters of the reproductive household. So Hijras, according to Europeans and British observers, you know, are people that would have been classified as male, who usually from a young age are initiated into a discipleship where they get to live as girls and women, but for a specific purpose, which is that their kind of sacred infertility as, you know, non-reproductive women allows them to bless and enhance, you know, marriages, you know, the birth of children, pregnancies, and so on in other households. And so Hijras were, you know, kind of all around in the subcontinent in the mid-19th century, but very visible in public. You know, either could be singing and dancing for money on particular auspicious occasions, and also had a role in being permitted with religious sanction to beg for money. And so, you know, giving money to Hijras had a really specific kind of importance to people. And so they're there, they're doing their thing, right? And as part of the British kind of campaign to consolidate colonial power, they're experiencing quite a number of moral panics over Indian society. Hijras are one that really stand out because of the just sheer aggression that the British train on them. They are profoundly alarmed by the existence of Hijras, whose very just passive presence, again, seems to transgress every British standard at the time. So Hijras transgress that in two ways. First of all, they're women in public, right? But also, the British think they're transgressing it in their person, that these are male-bodied people dressed as women. And so they immediately sort of throw this kind of accusation at them that, one, that they're all sex workers, which is not true, and two, that the combination of their body and the clothing they wear will seduce normal men into sodomy. So there's the homosexual panic already, right? And really what's underneath all of that is an anxiety over colonial power. There had been a huge rebellion in 1857, and the British almost completely lost control of India. And so they want to figure out how to pacify the society. And so targeting certain groups, right, is scapegoating them. Applying intense pressure is both a way to consolidate power, but also show other people the power of the British crown and the British state. And so they target Hijras through a specific law that actually is intended to eradicate them. It's actually a genocidal policy and project meant to destroy, like kill all remaining Hijras or allow them to quote unquote die out. And the way they do that is they criminalize everything about them. And specifically, they charge the police with enforcing the law. And here was the kind of like light bulb moment for me. I was reading this passage in Hinchey's book about a police officer giving a field report that he had gone into town, you know, in this province in India, encountered a Hijra in public. And so what he did was what he felt was his job. He stopped the Hijra, right? He, you know, apprehended her physically, you know, dominated her so that he could cut her hair, rip off all of her jewelry and ornaments, force her out of women's clothing and into men's clothing. In other words, he in public defeminized her, attacked her femininity, right, and tried to force her into a male appearance. Hijras are not trans women, just to say that out loud. It's a totally separate, you know, system, kidship and spiritual and gender system. So I was like, this is really interesting because this is happening before I see police targeting sort of what I would call modern trans women elsewhere in the world. Same dynamic, though, the police officer executing this strategy of defeminizing in public. So that was my first clue that that trans panic and trans feminization and trans misogyny actually might have been invented, you know, for groups of people who aren't trans women. And I was sort of trying to understand why. Well, here's the perfect case, right? The British aren't really that worried about hijras. They barely understand what hijras are. In fact, frankly, they don't really want to know. They invented a story about them to justify what? The consolidation of colonial power, and the police officer is the first frontline executor of that power. They are here. They can do that to hijras. Imagine what they could do to you. And so all of a sudden, I was like, oh, wow, why did trans misogyny emerge? If this is one of its births, right? Well, one reason why would be actually like nothing to do with trans people, and gender and sexuality are just pretenses. It's about colonial domination and racial power. And I just saw this pattern recurring all over the world.
So my question here is, if it was all about colonialism and not intentionally about trans women, or the attempt wasn't to trans feminize people necessarily, but it was all kind of swept up into this colonial project, do you think that this is a unique cycle as opposed to what we know about racism or what just cisgender racialized people have gone through in the project of colonialism? Like, do you think that it is mirroring these other patterns that we see applied to other groups of people? Or is there something unique specifically that trans feminized people or trans femme people threatened in the kind of colonial project at large?
It's a fabulous question. I think actually trans feminization is a relatively minor entry in a much larger colonial politics of gender and sexuality. And one thing that I think a lot of scholars, you know, scholars in Black studies, scholars in Indigenous studies, but scholars of colonialism more broadly have really sort of, I mean, there are decades of scholarship on this now, have shown is that it's not just that like Europeans arrive somewhere or Americans arrive somewhere to colonize and like say, well, we're men and women and we're straight and you're not. Actually, that like Western European and American concepts of gender and sexuality were created out of racist differentiation. So long histories. You can go all the way back like 500 years and see accounts of you know, Spanish conquistadors, you know, and their exceptionally violent arrival in the Caribbean, where one of the justifications they will write down in a chronicle and send back to the Spanish court is, well, we arrived here and we met this indigenous polity and we found that in, you know, the king's court, as we understood it, there were quote unquote men dressed as women, which is an abomination. And so we had the Christian mission to overthrow this political structure, murder the entire political class, steal the land, right? Enslave some of the population and plunder the area, right? It's an alibi. And so I think I would say one, right? We know a lot now about how colonialism and anti-Blackness tends to just treat an entire group of people as improperly gendered and sexual, right? And so there is no need to distinguish further than that. That's partly what I think transfeminization helps us understand, right? It's like the state doesn't need to make fine-grained distinctions to accomplish really brute kinds of actions. And so it just won't. I think the only other thing I could say is that maybe the specific reason why transfeminization has been so important is about the history of sex work. It's that, you know, modern industrial economies and cities all over the world, but certainly colonial ones, and I'm including the United States because it's a settler colony and a settler society, you know, the growth of industrial cities is accompanied by the growth of red light districts. And there's no shortage of women sex workers, but interestingly, basically everywhere in the world, you also start to see trans feminine sex workers. And, you know, part of what happens there, I think, is that those women's economic and social role is to provide comfort and care and companionship and a whole bunch of other things to men, including to men in power, police officers, soldiers, politicians, very famous, well-ensconced people are going out with the Goyles, still true to this day. And so that actually does mean they're very proximate to power, right? People in power know trans women and know trans feminized people through sex work or just through nightlife in general in the service economy, but they don't want to give them any power there.
Wow. Okay. So it is specific and it's also not specific is kind of the answer, right? It's like
such a professor's answer, but yeah.
Well, you give the beautiful long answer and my role is to see what you're saying and summarize in the way that I'm receiving it. But I want to move towards discussing the difference between street queens and drag queens, because I think that it's really important, given that this episode is running in Pride Month, we're talking about the intricacies within the queer community, to needle in on transmisogyny within the community itself. And I think you begin to kind of start to do that, and then we get narrower and narrower and narrower with the chapter on street queens. So I want to take us there. Can you just start by telling us who street queens are?
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. People probably know about street queens, but don't know that that's what they're called, right? Sylvia Rivera, Marsha P. Johnson were street queens, but we don't tend to call them that anymore. It was this term that had a lot of currency in the 60s, but it started to go out of fashion in the 70s. So forgive everyone for not knowing it. So street queen is a term that only has meaning vis-a-vis drag queen, or maybe more aptly a stage queen. So in the 50s and the 60s, you know, in gay bars, you had drag queens performing on stage in an era where appearing in public in drag was largely criminalized, you know, based on local ordinance. So depending on where you lived. You know, basically, you know, think about gay bars, you can go back and read sociologists who went and studied them. It's like you'd go into a gay bar, and the thing that was very different about it than other bars in America was not just that people were gay. It was that you had like a banker, right, sitting at the bar next to, say, a longshoreman. And that was just like, Americans are, despite what they say, very class conscious. And so gay people were forced by their circumstances to mix across class more than they probably wanted to. So that's really interesting. And in that context, right, the drag queen was pretty celebrated before Stonewall because she was the only person, like, who embraced the stigma of being gay, which was often dramatized as effeminacy or being, quote unquote, like a woman, like just wore that as a badge of honor, turned it into a job and an act. And actually, literally, like, the drag queen was the one person generally in the 60s who could make fun of straight people and get away with it because it was on stage, it was a performance. And the thing is, she would always get off stage and take off her drags, get out of makeup, and walk out that door as a man, because most of the time she was a man. The queen was not really a woman. Now, that also makes sense if you think that a drag queen doesn't want to get arrested on the way home from work every single day. But there were people who dared to, and this is what they would have said back then, wear drag in public. They were called street queens because they were in drag on the street. And that was not only illegal, it was seen as incredibly disreputable amongst gay people in general. So in this gay culture of the time, drag queens were venerated, but doing the very same thing in public by street queens was actually seen as trashy. It was understood as low class, even within the gay world, right? There's a separate class system that just mirrors the class system in American society. And so these street queens were kind of fixtures, oftentimes not just in the local bar scene, but more likely in public. And, you know, these queens were both reviled, but honestly, gay men were fascinated by them. On the one hand, they represented everything wrong with American society, how much you could be punished, right, for femininity or for beauty or, you know, for stepping out of line, how you could lose everything. And yet at the same time, because their demands were so bread and butter, right, they needed to get the police off their backs, they needed housing, they needed welfare, they needed money, and they needed access to things like medical transition, right? They needed just like material goods. They needed a different world. They needed a different society. And they sort of represented the promise of delivering gay people to a different world, one in which, like, not so much moral stigma would be reduced, but like the material conditions of everyone's lives would be so transformed that we wouldn't have to worry about moral stigma anymore. So the street queens were this really interesting group of people who were, you know, all over gay history, were really kind of central to gay culture. And then very abruptly after Stonewall, people kind of turned on them, which is, you know, I think the uncomfortable story of the start of the contemporary gay movement that we don't always like to talk about.
So let's go there.
Yeah.
Let's talk about trans femininity in the 70s and how gay and lesbian people turned on street queens. Could you describe the movement back then, the organizing, and, you know, as you've just mentioned, Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, their stories are now showered in a lot of reverence, but how are they treated when they were organizing?
Yeah, not very well. Actually, I think the best way to illustrate all this is like through a very specific example. So after Stonewall in New York City, there's just this burst of organizing. And because Stonewall happened in Greenwich Village, a lot of that organizing, you know, ends up circulating around NYU. So you have the emergence of the Gay Activist Alliance, the GAA, which is an early gay liberation organization, but a lot of its membership are people who aren't students. Those are actually transvestites and street queens. So who are kind of coming down from maybe the West 40s to organize. And so Sylvia and Marsha are in the organization from the beginning. Gay to them is a political as much as a personal identity. So, you know, there's this kind of famous sit-in in a hall at NYU, you know, over the right to hold a dance, a gay dance on campus, which is just sort of, you know, a way of provoking the administration and making demands. And basically what ends up happening is at this kind of key moment in this organizing where the sit-in is going to happen, you know, everyone shows up, but then they find out the NYPD is on its way. And everybody knows what the NYPD likes to do, how vicious and violent they can get. And what happens is a lot of the students at NYU who are white, gay, people gay in college education, who not inaccurately are like, you know, I kind of have a good thing going on here. I have a career waiting. Maybe I will get some civil rights. Maybe. And more importantly, I think this is the accusation the queens make at them. They're like, you're not willing to fight police. You're just not. You don't have the courage. So the gay contingent mostly leaves, abandons the queens alone in the hall to the NYPD. So imagine what happens when the cops show up. But it was that event that really led to the formation of what became Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, STAR, this kind of organization that often gets heralded, even though it only lasted a few years. But that was the reason for the split, was not that the girls weren't like, oh, we're so different than gay boys. They're like, you betrayed us. You betrayed the gay cause because you weren't willing to stick your neck out. But it really kind of magnifies from there. That is the foundation of the modern gay movement. It is the renunciation and the dismissal of poor street queens and trans femininity, saying, you're no longer our celebrated icon. We don't want anything to do with you anymore. But the only thing I end up saying about that, like having told that story, is like, okay, fast forward 50 years, where did that get us? I mean, we have more political homophobia now, arguably, than we did in the 70s, or it has barely changed. And the political transphobia is off the charts. Like, and in a way, I think what's weird to me is as we've come to venerate pride so intensely and tell these kind of like revisionist histories, it's like that's all lurking under the surface, but it's been very carefully like turned into something it wasn't. Like, it's just like, oh, we just need to celebrate these transgender women of color and know that they're important. It's like, but why were they important? Also, why did we forget them? Well, we turned on them. Like it's just like we threw away all the material politics. And so it's like the strange form of forgetting that then makes today's legal and political attacks feel really unprecedented and bewildering, when actually they're like totally predictable and logical if you look at the last 50 years of struggle. So I think the street queen is just someone we should go back to. We should come back to her power. We should think about the kind of world she was demanding. You know, she was more interested in abolition, right, than representation. And I just think like those are great touchstones. We don't have to make up anything new. We can just draw on stuff that's also not even that old. Like some of those people are still around, right? They're not all gone. And I think it's our difficult inheritance, but it's our inheritance nevertheless.
Oof, you just gave us so much there, Jules. And I think that that's always a good reminder that, you know, I think sometimes it's hard to confront like dark histories, but we can both confront dark histories and write a better one for the future. You also, you know, as we wrap up here, I think one of the notable solutions, you give a couple, one being like confronting our history, the other being this idea of how largely liberal feminists have relied on minimizing or rejecting femininity, and that in doing the opposite and living in the fullness of femininity and being perhaps even a little extra in our femininity, we could do more to liberate transfeminized people. This solution stems from the Mujerisma movement. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to this and what you think it could actually do in society today?
Yeah, this is the place where I think trans misogyny and misogyny link back up and provide us grounds for an incredible coalition and solidarity. Yeah, liberal feminism, I mean, most equality feminism just defeminizes women to achieve parity with men. You have to become more like a man in order to be respected. I think most women can relate to that in one way or another. And I just think that that's such a losing game. Ultimately, you're giving something up in order to hope that you'll be respected on someone else's terms. And I'm so impressed to see that, you know, in Latin America, for example, although it's not a unitary claim or concept, many different ways people articulate this claim defiantly and proudly of being the most. Mujer, woman, isima, like the most of the superlative. So mujerisima, the most woman. That's a bad translation, but it works. Like, and the claim there is not that everyone should become more feminine, but it's that some people are not afraid of being accused of being the most, because guess what? The most is the best. And for me, it's about this register shift in our political desires and imaginations. And so I just think, for me, Mujerisima, it's not a program. It's not a lifestyle. It's not an identity. It's not something for us to like appropriate. It's just a provocation to think about how if we built a world in which the travestis, you know, in which hijras, in which two-spirit people, in which trans women, in which sex workers were able, you know, to live, to flourish because they were given all the material things that they need, not the recognition or representation, but the material things. Well, that's probably a world that's going to basically set everyone else free. And I just think that that's a really simple way to build coalition, to build solidarity, to stop worrying about identity and to think about how we might come together strategically to create something much better than what frankly immiserates us all. But it turns out that the people who have been alienated the most tend to be the least afraid of saying what it would really take to build a world worth living in. And that to me just remains one of the stunning beauties of trans femininity that forever will be inspiring me, I know, in my life and my work.
Jules. That was beautiful. This has been so lovely to speak with you, and I am just so grateful for your work. So thanks so much for doing this with me.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. This was a fabulous conversation.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to At Liberty wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. Until next week, stay strong. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seismeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by the good folks at Ultraviolet Audio.